Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. In commemoration of National Holocaust Remembrance Day, we'll hear a panel discussion with four survivors of the SS St. Louis, one of the last ships to leave Nazi Germany before Europe was engulfed in war. It sailed from Hamburg, Germany, bound for Cuba on May 13, 1939. The ship, however, was forced to return to Europe after docking privileges were refused by several countries, including the United States. Following the German invasion of Europe, many of the former St. Louis passengers found themselves under Nazi rule and did not survive the Holocaust. The members of the panel will be Herbert Karliner, Philip Freund, Hans Fischer, and Saul Messinger. This program, presented in partnership with the Institute for Holocaust Education and Creighton University, was recorded on Friday morning, April 20, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Mick Hale, Director of Education at the Durham Museum.
This is Holocaust Remembrance Week, and the Holocaust, without question, is a very dark chapter in human history. It's difficult at times to hear these stories from this time period. But it's been my lesson as we've been doing these programs for the last couple of years. Quite often you find messages of inspiration and hope with all the sadness. Our four guests today took part on a very tragic voyage, the SS St. Louis. With us today, Colonel Philip Freund, who was born in Munich, Germany. After losing his father in 1937, he and his mother found a way to embark on the SS St. Louis in May of 1939. When the ship returned, he and his mother stayed in London until the outbreak of the war on September 1, 1939. They were able to leave on a Swedish vessel to New Jersey. There he was raised by an aunt and uncle and later moved to New York to work and help support his family. Philip enlisted with the U.S. Army in 1951 and retired as a colonel in 1991. Colonel Freund is married to Belle Ann. They have four children and eight grandchildren. And I would like to add that yesterday was their 55th wedding anniversary. Our next guest, Herbert Karliner, was born in Germany. In 1939, after Kristallnacht, his family purchased permits to go to Cuba on the St. Louis. The ship was refused entry to Cuba and the United States. Upon return to Europe, I apologize, Herbert. My notes all of a sudden disappeared. Herbert Karliner, Herbert will give you his story, I'm sure, as we go through. Herbert, would you please recognize, wave to folks. I apologize. Saul Messinger, born in Berlin, recalls the smoke coming from the synagogue when Jewish schools reopened after Kristallnacht in 1938. Prior to this, his father had been taken away in the middle of the night, but somehow returned and they were able to board the SS St. Louis in May as a family. After the boat was forced to turn back to Europe, the Messingers made their way to France, Spain, and Portugal before immigrating to the United States, to Buffalo. Saul is a clinical and anatomic pathologist. He's very involved in the Buffalo Jewish Federation, the Holocaust Resource Center, and the Jewish Day School in Buffalo. Saul Messinger. And lastly, as a child, Hans Fischer left Germany by boat on the St. Louis, headed for Cuba with his mother and sister. They planned to join his father, who had fled to Cuba months earlier after being released from Buchenwald, where he'd been interned on Kristallnacht. When the ship's passengers were refused entry by Cuba and the United States 70 years ago, and perhaps the most notorious example of the West's ambivalent response to the Holocaust, his family ended up in the small French town of Laval. It took many months for the family to finally reunite. He came to the United States in 1941. He was hired at Rutgers in 1954, and Dr. Fischer recently retired from teaching and research after 52 years, serving 22 years as the chair of the nutrition department. He has also served as an associate provost in another university positions. Ladies and gentlemen, Hans Fischer. And with that, I will turn it over to our special guests.
Well, all of us were born in Germany. I was born in 1932 in Berlin. I was a little kid, but realized very quickly that under Hitler, Jews were not particularly loved. I was beaten up. The two most traumatic events that I remember is, this was in 1938, October 38, in the middle of the night, there was a knock on the door, and it was the Gestapo, which is the secret police of Germany, and they came to pick up my father. We didn't know where they were taking him. It turned out that my parents had come from Poland some years before, and they had arrested all Jews of Polish origin, Jewish men of Polish origin, and shipped them back to Poland. So although at the time that they came to our house, we assumed that they were taking my father to a concentration camp. And then 2 weeks later, there was Kristallnacht, where the synagogues in Germany were destroyed. I actually don't remember Kristallnacht itself, but the school that I was going to, I was in first grade, was next to the synagogue where we used to go. And of course, the day after Kristallnacht, my mother, well, all the schools were closed, the Jewish schools. The school opened 3 or 4 days after Kristallnacht. My mother took me there. And what I remember mostly was getting there and seeing the synagogue where we used to worship next to the school where I used to go, smoldering. And you could smell the smoke. And when I talk about it, I can still sort of smell the smoke. Anyway, we obviously wanted to get out of Germany. And we wanted to come to the United States, but it was very difficult to get a visa. And there were so many requests for visas to the United States. So what the United States government did was they gave, if they couldn't give you a visa, they gave you a number. And they said, when that number comes up, you'll get a visa to the United States. Of course, we didn't want to wait in Germany until we got that number. So we looked for another place to go to. And Cuba was one of the places that took people. So we actually got visas to Cuba, and we got passage on the ship, the St. Louis. My father was in Poland, as I mentioned, and by some miracle, they allowed him to come back for 2 days so we could get on the ship together. And we got on the ship on May 14th, 1939. Why don't you continue?
My name is Phil Freund, and I was born in Munich, 1931. And Saul had covered the beginning of the Nazi terrorist campaign quite adequately, except that in 1937, my father worked for my grandfather in a printing plant in Munich, and the board of directors decided that they had better leave Germany real quick, and so they tasked my father with taking money and going to either Holland or Sweden and setting up another plant. Well, he did that, but the Gestapo came in and did an audit of the books, found out that there was a considerable amount of money that had been taken out, and they wanted that money back. They arrested my mother, held her hostage until my father could return to Munich. When he returned, he was immediately picked up by the Gestapo, sent to Dachau concentration camp, and immediately executed. He's buried in a cemetery in Munich in a sealed casket. The Gestapo was at the funeral to make sure that my mother didn't open up the casket. God only knows what they did to him but he's buried there, and we have made pilgrimages back to Munich to pay homage to him. In 1938, the Kristallnacht situation took place. My mother was very much afraid of what was going on. I was playing with my toy train in the foyer when I heard the doorbell ring, and I thought it was my grandmother who lived around the corner. Well, it wasn't. It was a Gestapo agent who came in, started beating me up, threw me up against the wall, was about to stomp on me, when my mother heard the noise and came out and said, "What, you know, what's going on?" And the Gestapo agent said that he wanted to arrest my father for protective custody. That was the term that they used to arrest people. When my mother showed the agent the death certificate, he let us go. My mother called her high school girlfriend, Lotte Schlumberger, and told her what was going on, and Lotte said, "Find someone who will keep you safe, and I'll get you there." My mother called my father's platoon sergeant from World War I. My father was an officer in the Kaiser's Army, and he went from cadet to lieutenant. My mother called up the platoon sergeant, and he said he would harbor us while this period of extreme hatred of the Jews would subside. We got out there that evening. We went to the farmer's village, and then we went to the farmer's house, and I remember walking in on the ground floor and smelling the cattle. That's all I remember of that. But the next morning got up, and the farmer handed me a floppy hat, and I had to help him pick up sugar beets. That was his crop. Now, to hide Jews was extremely dangerous, because if they found out that you were harboring Jews, they would kill you, they would kill your family, they'd kill your animals, and they'd burn your house down. That's how vicious these people were. Well, we stayed there. Now, I have no idea how we got back to Munich, to our home. Each Jew had an ID card who was over 16, and on there was stamped a red letter J, and in the inside cover of the Kennkarte, the ID card, it said nationality. I think because my grandmother insisted that we're not Germans, that we were Bavarians, that the station master never questioned it when he saw the nationality as Bavarian. Went back, and later on in November, my mother found out that there was a ship leaving Hamburg called the SS St. Louis. She went and bought tickets for all four of us, my mother, grandmother, sister, and I. And also, she applied for visas a couple of years before that, and so she felt that we would be safe going to Cuba and using that as a stopover before we got to the United States. Well, it turned out that we got to Havana, and they wouldn't let us off the ship. And people started to really get upset because they knew the alternative was not too pleasant. I could see the cars on the causeway. I could see what was going on in Miami. And still, we could not get off the vessel. The Coast Guard came and drove us into international waters, where we stayed until if they found a place that would accept us. Sad to say, Canada didn't want us. They said that none is one too many. The United States certainly didn't want us. Mexico didn't want us. Cuba definitely did not want us. And Dominican Republic wanted us as long as we paid another $500 per person. Now, where are you going to get $500 sitting in a ship in the middle of the Atlantic? But so we went back to Europe. And fortunately, a gentleman by the name of Mr. Troper, who was with the refugee committee, he contacted the British, and he told them that France was willing to take so many, X number of us, and how many would the British take? And the British said, well, if the French are willing to take so many, then, well, they can take quite a few. The same thing happened with the Dutch and the Belgians. Sad to say, because nothing was done to save us, 254 of us passengers succumbed in the camps or were executed immediately. That's the really the sad part. And later on, the Wannsee Conference, which took place in Berlin, promulgated what was going to happen to the Jews in Germany. They were going to all be killed. That was the beginning of the final solution. So Hitler knew quite well what was going on as far as the St. Louis people was concerned. He knew we weren't going to get off that vessel. And finally, my family, we went to England, so we were saved. And then we came to the United States, Christmas Eve, 1939, and my mother, grandmother, and sister went to New York to live. I stayed in Hackensack, New Jersey, with my uncle and my mother's twin sister, and I stayed there until the end of World War II. And then when I was old enough to get a job, in delivering furniture and later on delivering pharmaceuticals, graduated high school, joined the Army, and I was fortunate enough to be in a position where the Army treated me extraordinarily well. As a sideline, I'd like to introduce to you a gentleman who I had the pleasure of serving with, one of your own local people, Colonel David McBlain. Stand up, Dave. An outstanding instructor, and I am proud to say that I served with this man.
Your turn. There are, of course, many parallels between my story and what you have just heard. My story also begins with Kristallnacht. The next morning, we had no idea that Kristallnacht had taken place. The next morning, I got up to go to school, and I noticed all the broken glass in the streets, but I had no idea what their significance was. When I got near my school, there were wooden barriers and police said, you can't go any further. And before I had much time to even think about it, a cry went up, look, look, the synagogue is burning. And all I could see was smoke in the sky, black smoke. I couldn't see the synagogue. It wasn't right at that location. But in any case, I turned around and I ran home and I told my parents what had taken place. And within a few minutes, the doorbell rang and two Gestapo agents came and they politely told my father to pack a small bag and to come along with them, which he did. A few minutes later, there was a loud knock on the door. I opened it up and there were two SS men in their black uniforms and boots, and they came in shouting, screaming, where are you hiding the weapons? And they went through all the drawers and closets and just helter-skelter, threw everything on the floor. Did this for about 10, 15 minutes and then just slammed the door and left. And then we found out that my father had been taken to Buchenwald and he was lucky. A friend of his, a lawyer friend, got him a visa to go to Cuba, and armed with that visa and having fought in World War I for the German fatherland, he was released in January of 39 with the understanding that he had to leave within 2 weeks. And then he left January 19th for New York and from New York to Havana, Cuba. And then my mother, my sister, and I were to follow and we ended up following on the St. Louis in May of 1939, and you've heard this now from my colleagues. Obviously, we weren't permitted to get off. My father rented a little rowboat, and these little rowboats would circle the St. Louis, and you could barely see these people because it was a pretty high ship, and we were all the way on the deck up top, and these boats were all the way in the water, and you certainly couldn't talk with one another. At least we could see each other, and the boat actually wasn't even permitted into Havana Harbor proper. It was outside in a place called Morro Island. And I still remember I was playing chess with a friend of mine when suddenly the boat weighed anchor and slowly left Havana and then cruised in front of Miami. And as you heard, we could see the lights of Miami in the evening. I also remember a Coast Guard cutter chasing the boat away into international waters, and then slowly started on its return trip until, as you heard, the four countries, Belgium, Holland, England, and France, each agreed to take about a quarter of the passengers. And the boat landed in Antwerp, Belgium. Those that went to England were transshipped to another boat that went to England. And those of us who went to England, to France, which includes Herbert Carlina and myself, we were also put on another boat. It was just an overnight trip by boat to France. And I was in France together with Herb for several months. And then my father was fortunate enough to be able to get visas again for us to come to Cuba. And we left in December of 39 on a French boat, which first went to Southampton, England, where we waited for almost 10 days until a convoy of close to 200 ships assembled, because those were the days when the German submarines, U-boats, were sinking ships, including American merchant ships, right and left, because the U.S. was supplying arms aid to Great Britain. These 200 ships then, under escort of British warships, made their way to New York, and we were very fortunate. Not a single boat was sunk. When we got to New York, my mother, my sister, and I were taken to Ellis Island because we didn't have immigration papers for the United States. So we were placed on Ellis Island until there was a boat to Cuba, I think about 4 days, and then we were reunited with my father in Havana. We were in Havana for another full year because my father was Polish quota under a very crazy immigration law that was put through in 1924. And we had to wait till his quota number came up, which finally came up when the war was in full swing in 1941. And then we were able to come to the States. And eventually we settled in southern New Jersey on a poultry farm. And I spent 5 years in Vineland going to high school, graduated as valedictorian, and because of that I got a 4-year scholarship to Rutgers and graduated from there, and eventually got a doctorate at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana, and then ended up back at Rutgers as a faculty member for 50-some-odd years. Our contributions, for which I'm ever grateful to the United States, because with all its faults, it's the greatest country in the world. People should only take proper advantage of what is available here, education-wise and work-wise and otherwise. We have 3 children, all of whom are professionals, 10 grandchildren. We're going to the best colleges, universities in the country. And my wife and I are very, very proud of their achievements and are very, very grateful for having had the opportunity to have them grow up in this great country.
My name is Herb Karliner. I was born in Germany, eastern part close to the Polish border. In 1938, I don't have to repeat, you heard about Kristallnacht. My father had a store, a grocery store, and when he went down to the store, was completely destroyed. And somebody came and said, the synagogue is burning. So my father and myself went to the synagogue. Sure enough, the SR, the brown shirt, had a bonfire, and they threw the Torah in the fire. My father was trying to retrieve it, but he was kicked and couldn't make it. Then somebody came and told us the Gestapo is coming to pick us up. So we went home, we didn't know what to do. When the Gestapo came, they just picked up my father and took him to Buchenwald. We had to clean up the store and the things else, and we had to sell our business and our house. And the only way to get my father out from the Buchenwald is we had to show that we're going to leave Germany in the next 3 months. We are on a quota to come to the United States, but we had to wait. The only place was open was China. So we bought some permits to go to China. And then my father came out after 3 weeks. I didn't recognize him because he was maltreated there. Then we found out that a Cuban consul in Hamburg selling permits to go to Cuba. So we bought the permits to go to Cuba. My family was my parents. I had 2 sisters and a brother. We left Germany May 30, 1939, and was glad to leave Germany because there was no future for us. I was kicked out from school. I used to love to play soccer. But then said to kick the ball, the German boys kicked my feet. And my mother didn't ever let me play again with them. If you want to go on a bus, we just sit in the back of the bus. If you want to walk on the sidewalk, the Hitler Youth pushed us on the street. We were not allowed. And my dream was always to come to the United States. Anyway, it was very difficult for my parents to leave Germany. They lived there for century, but for us, I was glad. We arrived in Havana, we had our suitcase all prepared, and the Spanish Cuban police came up and said we have to check the papers. We had to wait 1 day, 2 days, 3 days. The first word I learned in Spanish was mañana, but mañana never came. We were there about a week in the harbor, and the American Joint Distribution Committee was negotiating with the Cuban government. They wanted to give them $1 million to keep us there for a while. The Cuban wanted $2 million. We wanted to give them $2 million. They wanted $4 million. They were horse trading. And finally, the Cuban government said, you have to get out of there. And the captain was a hell of a nice guy. We sent telegrams all over the world to President Roosevelt. We didn't get no answer. Went the telegram to Mrs. Roosevelt, the children of the ship. Again, we didn't get no answer. We sent telegram to Canada, South America, Central America. Nobody wanted us. The captain took us around Strait of Florida. And let me tell you, I was 12 and a half years old. And I happened to see Miami Beach. And I was very much impressed. And I said, I would like to live there someday. Well, it took me a long time around. We had to go back to Europe, and as we told you, we were changed to different countries. We came to France. We didn't know anybody in France. We didn't speak the language. And the organization came up and said, anybody who wants to take the children to a children's home, they will take them, because my parents were not allowed to work. So my parents sent the two boys, my brother and myself, to a children's home in France. And 3 months later, the war broke out. And a year later, we were again occupied by the Germans. My parents were in the occupied zone of France, and we were, with my brother, in the unoccupied zone. I was arrested in August 26, 1942, but you have to have luck in life. They took only boys over 16 years old, and I was 1 week before my 16th birthday, and they released me. Well, all my friends from the children who were over 16 were taken and were shipped to Germany. I never heard from them again. Right after this, the organization gave me some false papers, changed my name, and said to go to Spain and then to Palestine. We came to Spain, we were arrested in Spain, and were shipped back to France. So the organization sent us to Switzerland. We run over the mountains to Switzerland. We arrested in Switzerland. And the police said, we have too many refugees. And they sent us back to France. Finally, I landed in a small village in a farm. The people needed help, because all the men were prisoners of war in Germany. So they accepted us. And I went to a farm, and he asked me what the religion I was. I said, Catholic. He said, good, you're going to go to church with us every Sunday. Well, I never been to a church, but I was smart enough to go behind my boss, and whatever he did, I did too, and I got away with it. My brother was in a different place, and he was also working in a farm. We didn't have much contact. I found out my parents were arrested in November 1942 with my sisters and shipped to Drancy, the camp, and then to Germany. I never heard from them either, never. Myself, in 1944, we were liberated by the American Army. I wanted to join the Army, American Army. They didn't want me because they didn't know who I really was. I told him I was German, Jewish. He said, maybe you are infiltrating the American Army. So he said, you better go back to the organization who vouched for you. I found them, and they asked me to stay with them, because they said, we have thousands of children in different convents and farms, and we need people like you to find them. So I worked with them. We found a lot of children and so on. But in each department, we had a person who hit the children in different farms and so on. And they had the list. But they got caught too and shipped to Auschwitz and never came back. We haven't got the list. I assure you, there are people who are Jewish children who live now in France and they are now converted to Catholicism or whatever it is. They don't know they were Jewish. Anyway, I came here to the United States, and my uncle sent me an affidavit to come to the States, and I came to Hartford, Connecticut on 1947, January. I went to night school, and I didn't want no charity. I went to work right away as a pot washer in a restaurant, and I met a guy in night school who said he's going to Miami for the winter. He had a car. I said, can I go with you? He said, sure. So my dream came through. I came to Miami in 1949. It was a paradise. And I worked there for a year. And then I got a letter from Uncle Sam. I want you. In 1939, he didn't want me. I was drafted in the army. I passed my interpreter test, French and German. And where do you think they sent me? To Korea. You know, it's the old saying, the right way, the wrong way, and the army way. Right, Colonel?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Anyway, I came out the army. Thank goodness I came out the army after 2 years, and I went back to Miami. I worked in different places. Oh, yeah, and I never went back to school. I didn't finish even elementary school. But I learned by myself in France when I had to go to work too. And there was an opening in a bakery, so I started to work in a bakery. And when I came to the States, I went from one bakery to another. I learned from each place, from one to the other. Finally, I worked 12 years in the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami Beach, the famous hotel there. We had fantastic pastry chefs from Germany and Switzerland. I learned a lot. Then I opened my own bake shop and had it for 20 years. Afterward, I retired and I work for the Holocaust Memorial in Miami Beach and teaching the children all about all my experience, because I feel it can happen again. That's why we all work to tell people our experience. The world is not free yet from all the things what happened to us, and it can happen again. So we want the new generation to know for our experience, be aware about anti-Semitism, and be, how you say, to be aware of all the other the religion. Tolerance. Be tolerant to all people. Thank you for listening to us.
Oh, great. Actually, I stopped telling you my story when we got on the St. Louis, so let me finish. We ended up in Belgium, and we lived there for a year, actually 11 months, until the Germans invaded in 1940, and we fled to France. And fortunately, we fled in France as far as we could go, which was the Spanish border. The Spaniards wouldn't let us cross the border. So we lived in southern France. And we had been in France for 3 months when the French policemen arrested us, arrested all Jewish refugees and put us in detention camps, not concentration camps, but detention camps, and which was not anything as bad as concentration camps, but it was bad enough. It was pretty horrible, and I won't go into the details, but we were very lucky, my parents and I, because we managed to escape from this detention camp. We went back to the village in France where we had lived, and by some miracle, in the winter of 1942, our visa number to the United States, for which we had applied in Germany, I think in 1935, 7 years before, came through. And we had a visa to the United States. Then we had to find a method of getting to the United States. Of course, airplanes, you know, there weren't many planes at that time. And it was in the middle of the war anyway, so even if you could get on a plane, you couldn't do it. We finally found a Portuguese ship that we were able to get on. And we came to the United States in June of 1942, in the middle of the war. A month later, and I think you mentioned this, a month later, the Jews in France were arrested, including the Jewish people who were in the village with my family and me, and they were all sent to Auschwitz. So my parents and I missed it by a month. We landed in New York. My two aunts, who had also lived in Berlin, and who had made it to Cuba, and who were on those little boats sailing around the ship when we were there, had come to the United States in 1941. They had settled in Buffalo. So when we came to the United States, we settled in Buffalo too. I started school 2 months after I came to the States, and 2 months later I was speaking English fluently. And so I continued in public school and high school, and was lucky enough to get a scholarship to the University of Buffalo. I was lucky because my father was a tailor, and we, when we came to the United States, all we had was debts. So anyway, I went to the university. Then I went to medical school in Buffalo, did my internship and residency there, and then I served in the Army for a couple of years. I was stationed in New York City, and then went back to Buffalo and practiced until 3 years ago. I do want to say one thing, which really doesn't have anything to do with my story, but if you talk to people who survived, Jewish people who survived the Holocaust, you generally see that in spite of all the stuff that we went through, we managed to do pretty well and to contribute to society wherever we were. And I can't help thinking about all the millions who were killed in the Holocaust and how they might have contributed to society if they had survived. Anyway, I think we've talked enough. Maybe the audience would like to ask questions.
The question was, who decided what happened? Who could get off? All the passengers got off. The boat went back and docked in Antwerp, Belgium, and all 937 passengers got off. They were divided mostly by lot, unless you had some compelling reason why you wanted to stay in Belgium or go to Holland or France or England. And they were simply divided into four groups, and then, as I mentioned, were transshipped to England and to France, and the ones who stayed in Belgium took a train, I believe, from Antwerp to Brussels, and those who went to Holland also got on a train and took the train to Holland.
The panel was asked if they could tell about their school experiences after the war.
Well, we went to Brussels. I went to school in Brussels, I have very little memory of that, except that I was miserable. I didn't speak French, and it was bad. And then we were in France, and I went to school in France. Now, we were in a little village, and I think 200 people lived in the village, and there was one schoolhouse, and there were eight grades there, and all eight grades were in the same room, and we had one teacher, and that teacher taught, took turns teaching kids of different ages different things. After a month in France, I spoke English, spoke French fluently, and so we did. I did go to school. During the 3 years between the St. Louis and the time that I came to the United States.
I didn't go to school because I was in a children home, and the children home, I didn't have too much money. And since I was 13 years old, the people in the village, all the people were taken in the army, were prisoner of war in Germany, and they needed help. So the organization, the children home, sent me to the village, and there was an opening in a bakery in the village. That's where I started. That's why I didn't go to school. I had to work there. I worked there for 2.5 years, and I learned some baking. And then in August 26, 1942, the French police came, picked me up, and put me in a camp. But like I mentioned to you, you have to have luck in life, and it was released. And then I had to work in a farm, so I never had the chance to go back to school. And when I came to the States, again, I didn't want no charity for my family or for anybody else. I went to work. My first job, I didn't speak English, but I went to a place, the gentleman, the manager, he spoke a Yiddish, and I worked there as a pot washer, and little by little I worked myself up to be a baker. And so I never went to baking school either, but I learned by myself, and I made it. I'm here.
I ended up in Hackensack, New Jersey, and I had to live with my aunt and uncle. My aunt and my mother were twins. My mother told me she had no money to sustain me, so I had to stay with my uncle. And I was enrolled in State Street School in Hackensack. When my mother took me there, I could not speak English, I could not read, I was 8 years old, so I was totally ignorant. Well, the teacher assigned George Cotty to be my mentor. And one day he said to me, "Do you have a library card?" I said, "No, I'm Jewish and I don't have any money." And he said, "We're going to the library and get you a card." So we went to the State Street Library, and the lady behind the desk asked me what I wanted. And I said, "I need a library card, but I'm Jewish and I don't have any money." That's how brainwashed I was, the fact that I didn't realize that in this country you can go to a library and get a free book to read. This was amazing to me. Within a couple of years, I was reading above grade level, and then when I went to high school, I couldn't devour enough books, and my wife will testify to you that I drive her crazy with all these books. Because that's knowledge, and we can't waste it. It's terribly important. George Cotty was very good to me, and I'm sorry I sort of lost track to him.
A member of the audience asked for the panel's current thoughts about the United States in light of the fact that the U.S. originally rejected them.
Well, first of all, we came to this country, the land of opportunity. We really believe that, and we still do, and I certainly still do. People die to come here. They leave their homeland and all they want to do is come here because they have the opportunity to do something with their life, not only for themselves, but for other people too, society as a whole. So it always amazes me. And I was stationed in Ethiopia, in Turkey, in Thule, Greenland, in Spitsbergen. You can name some crazy places where I spent some time. But I always was delighted to return to the States. And when they flew me in over New York City, I always asked the pilot, "Please, make a circle around the Statue of Liberty." It is so emotional for me to even think that I can see the Statue of Liberty, which to me spells liberty, freedom, opportunity.
I have a friend. I have a friend who was in St. Louis, but he went to Palestine. And he said he never would put foot to the United States because he didn't let us in. And he never came to the States. He still lives in Israel. Myself, I was very disappointed when I left in Miami and with 150,000 Cuban refugees came to Miami with no question asked, no papers whatsoever, and they let them in. And we were 900 Jews, educated. We didn't ask the state, United States, to support us because we had relatives here and we were always very ambitious to work. And nobody would listen to us. My dream was always to come to the States. When I was a little boy, I was reading books, and the book, the the guy who wrote the book, his name was Karl May. Please don't confuse him with Karl Marx. And he wrote wonderful books about him. If there wouldn't be a Hitler, I think it would, I still would come to the United States. Was my dream.
Somebody asked the same question yesterday, and I'll give you a similar answer. The United States is made up of immigrants. I mean, all of us are ancestors of immigrants. And we need immigrants. I mean, immigrants are sort of the lifeblood of the United States. I mean, the United States is amazing because we have the ability somehow to assimilate immigrants. After a couple of generations or one generation, the immigrants are Americans. So we need immigrants. But my problem with immigration today is that I don't mind immigrants. I like them. But I don't think that they should immigrate illegally. I think that this country is a country of laws, and we need to follow the law. Now, I think we need immigrants, and we should have more of them. And consequently, I think what needs to be done is the law needs to be changed so that we can get more immigrants in legally. That's my feeling about immigrants.
An audience member asked why there were no countries who would let the Jews on the St. Louis Inn.
Because at that time, every country that had taken a few Jews in said, okay, it's enough, we have enough, we don't want any more. And no country wanted to take us in.
I'm sorry.
Canada, as an example. The Minister of Immigration, his comment was, none is one too many. In this country, President Roosevelt said, get these people out of the Western Hemisphere. I don't want them here.
We're still trying to find out why any countries wouldn't let us in. And that's, we feel there was something behind the scene. The propaganda minister, Goebbels, made a statement when the countries wouldn't let us in that nobody wants the Jews so we can do whatever we want to them. I think that's the beginning of the Holocaust. Who organized this? I don't know. Trying to find out if the German government put pressure on all those countries not to say some, to let us in. I remember when I was in the St. Louis, I used to go to the telegraph things where they get the telegram. I was always interested in that. And one day a telegram came from the Dominican Republic, said they will let us in. So we were very excited. Next day, they refused us. We were wondering why. We went to Havana, trying to find out, get some papers there from the German consul or from the Cuban. We couldn't find nothing. We went to Dominican Republic, again we didn't find nothing. I spoke to, in Miami Beach one time, there was a Cuban woman, and she said she was working for the Cuban government. And she remembered she got a telegram from the American government not to let the St. Louis. Now please, I cannot, that's what she told us. Is it true? I don't know. We haven't got no proof. So we're wondering, still wondering why. The United States let us in afterwards, a lot of people came here or to Cuba, Dominican Republic. They let some people in. Why just the St. Louis? That is the question. We're still wondering.
As a final question, the panel was asked whether they see similarities between the Nazi attack on religious freedom against Jews in the Holocaust to the Obama administration's HHS mandate against Catholics in the United States.
Look, one of the things that we always say when we commemorate the Holocaust is we feel it's very important to know what happened then so that it would never happen again. We say that, but it has happened again since then in Africa and so on. And I'm afraid that it can happen again. It's horrible to say that, but I really think that it could.
Look what's happening in the Muslim countries. They're teaching the children, all the infidel, not only the Jews, all the Christian or whatever, infidel, has to be killed because they're not learning the Muslim Korean prayer. And they're so fanatics. You know, I'm teaching them from children on. That's why we're trying to teach it, the new generation, our experience, to be aware of what's happening to us and to be careful.
And of course, unfortunately, not only this fanaticism, but then you have those who deny that the Holocaust ever happened. And so, as you heard, we're among the last of the Mohicans who are still around who can personally testify to it. So, in another few years, when we are gone, all you can rely on is history books and other written accounts, although now, fortunately, you also have pictorial accounts, seeing us speak and other people speak, which hopefully will help. But that's why it's so important to have the opportunity to speak to an audience like yourself who can hear that firsthand, and if, as we hope, you believe us, you will pass us on, and that message will get transmitted way beyond us. So thank you for coming.
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. In commemoration of National Holocaust Remembrance Day, we've heard a panel discussion with four survivors of the SS St. Louis, one of the last ships to leave Nazi Germany before Europe was engulfed in war. The members of the panel were Herbert Karliner, Philip Freund, Hans Fischer, and Saul Messinger. This program, presented in partnership with the Institute for Holocaust Education and Creighton University, was recorded on Friday morning, April 20, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Shauna Forsberg, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Special thanks also to Mike Irwin, Distance Learning Coordinator at the Durham Museum, for providing the recording of today's program. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.